We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, protactinium, and indium, and gallium, and iodine, and thorium, and thulium, and thallium. There's yttrium, ytterbium, actinium, rubidium, and boron, gadolinium, niobium, iridium, and strontium, and silicon, and silver, and samarium, and bismuth, bromine, lithium, beryllium, and barium. There's holmium and helium and hafnium and erbium and phosphorus and francium and fluorine and terbium and manganese and mercury, molybdenum, magnesium, dysprosium and scandium and cerium and cesium and lead, praseodymium and platinum, plutonium, palladium, promethium, potassium, polonium and tantalum, technetium, titanium, tellurium and cadmium and calcium and chromium and curium. There's sulfur, californium, and fermium, berkelium, and also mendelevium, einsteinium, nobelium, and argon, krypton, neon, radon, xenon, zinc, and rhodium, and chlorine, carbon, cobalt, copper, tungsten, tin, and sodium. These are the only ones of which the news has come to Harvard. And there may be many others, but they haven't been discovered.
Welcome to Focus. Good morning, I'm Bill Hammack. Today, as you might guess from that song, I'm taking a deep look at the chemical elements. My guest today wrote the book, The Elements, A Visual Exploration of Every Known Atom in the Universe. It's an absolutely gorgeous book, beautifully laid out, but also chock full of fascinating information. In addition to the bound version, we'll discuss his iPad adaptation of the book and also probe his thoughts about the iPad as a medium for distributing books. I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL if you're in the area or if you're anywhere else in North America. Call me at 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Also, keep in mind that you can listen to WILL live online. And if you like, send a question to me via email at WILL-live@illinois.com. So let's welcome to Focus, Teo Gray.
Hello. Glad to be here.
So, Teo, I want to give listeners a flavor of this very visual book. Could you just take 2 pages of a particular element and describe what a reader would see and learn from them?
Well, the book is laid out in 2-page spreads, as you know. Every element gets 2 pages, except for some of the sort of insignificant elements at the very end. Silver, for example, on the left-hand side, we have a great big picture of a Greek coin. It's 2,238 some years old. But actually cheaper to buy the coin than to license a photograph of it, which is sort of interesting. On the right-hand side, we have several paragraphs of text about silver that discusses its properties and its, interesting little facts about it. And then we have a bunch of pictures of things you can do with silver. For example, of course, the obvious bullion bar that's representing silver as its sort of monetary unit. But also a silver tracheostomy tube, which is a thing you stick down your throat if you've had an operation to clear a blocked breathing passage. And they're made out of silver because of its antimicrobial properties. And we have one of my favorite samples, a pair of silver shorts, which are basically boxer shorts made out of silver thread for people who are worried about electromagnetic interference with I don't know if that's really a real concern. But anyway, if you're worried about it, you can buy silver shorts and silver pants and silver drapes and silver everything because of its very high electrical conductivity. It's a good shielder.
Then on the right-hand column, there's a great deal of technical information about it, right? We have the crystal structure and where it is in the periodic table and some graphs at the very bottom, right?
We've tried to put in a certain amount of useful information. People shouldn't mistake this book as a technical book about elements where you would get atomic weight and everything. It's in there, but it's kind of there for completeness. Something even Bill may not have realized is if you take the book and you fan the pages out, we actually have a little graph on the right-hand side that gives you a graph of the melting and boiling points of all the elements as a function of their atomic weight. And it's actually interesting to look at the patterns. There's quite a good bit of periodicity to the patterns in these physical properties.
So a little like a flip movie. It doesn't animate, but it's the same kind of principle. So, you know, there's a lot of ways to enter into this book, but this was obviously a great labor of love for you. So maybe we'll start a little personal. What, is there an element that's just the most interesting to you?
Ah, you and every school child wants to know, what's my favorite element?
I feel in good company.
Yes. Well, that's everybody asks me, what's your favorite element? And my first answer always is, I don't have a favorite child either. I love all the elements. However, titanium is awfully nice. I think mainly because I have so many really nice samples of it, the beautiful jet engine parts and titanium crowbars and things like that. And hip joints and gears and crystals, and it's just a lovely little metal.
Well, maybe let's start then with those samples, those pieces you have. Did you start out by meaning to write a book, or did you start out just acquiring things?
No, I actually started out needing a table. The rest of it is entirely accidental. We had recently moved my office to a new part of the building, and we had a big open area, and I needed a conference table to use for having little group meetings at. And I had been reading this book, Uncle Tungsten, by Oliver Sacks, which is a wonderful book, and he describes a periodic table in the Kensington Science Museum that he used to visit as a child. And I thought he was talking about a table, you know, a flat table that had samples of elements on it. But it turns out he wasn't. He just meant the thing on the wall, same as everybody else's periodic table. But this gave me the idea that we need a table. And apparently, as far as I could tell, there was no such thing as a periodic table anywhere in the world. So I built one. And I ended up putting little compartments in it where samples of elements could go. And so I thought, well, I better get some elements to put in these compartments. And then I discovered eBay, which turns out to be a fantastic source of weird stuff, including pretty much any element you'd want to buy. You can find it there somewhere. So actually, within a few months, I started to have a reasonable collection. And within a few years, I had a pretty complete collection. And I started photographing them and pretty soon put together a poster and... You know, slowly started to think, you know, I ought to probably do a book. But it was all, you know, entirely unplanned and unintentional and started from the desire for a conference table.
Well, in fact, my first contact with Uteo was about 10 years ago, maybe pre-eBay possibly. You sent me a note. I'd been on the radio here and you sent me a note and you were looking for a particular element. And did I know a source? And I don't remember what that was. So the pictures in this book are largely, if not completely, ones that... of things that you own, is that right?
Basically, everything in here is in my office, except we have a very small number. There's an MRI machine to represent something. I didn't happen to have an MRI machine, although I had a chance of getting one from the old Burnham Hospital one time, and I turned them down. Sorry, not an MRI, it was a CAT scan machine. Another one I don't have anymore is a niobium sample, which was confiscated by the FBI because it turned out it was not military surplus. It was stolen military material that had been sold on eBay. And they were very nice about it. They said, oh, yeah, we know your column. We know who you are. Don't worry about it. But we have to have the thing back now because it was apparently current usage on Minuteman missiles. It's some kind of a steering thruster with a niobium superalloy nozzle. So I don't have that one anymore.
So, Taylor, I have a lot of questions, but we have a caller, and I want to turn to the caller on line four from Belgium. So, caller?
Yes, and good morning to you all.
Good morning.
Now, this may seem like a very simple question, but I don't totally know how I can answer it or if you can answer it. Mm-hmm. We have all these elements. Where do they come from? Now, I know that they're generated inside this sun, starts with hydrogen, goes to helium, and builds on up till it gets to about iron. But there's a lot of elements beyond iron. How are they formed?
What an interesting question. Essentially, he's asking, is an element an element, or why is it an element?
Yeah, well, I think the current understanding about where elements beyond iron come from is that it's pretty much supernova that generate these things. And so, you know, a planet like Earth is the product not of primordial hydrogen and helium that have been fused together, but rather the product of supernova that have exploded. And the evidence for that is the fact that we have elements beyond iron. But this is actually understood in some detail. I can't tell you the specifics about where each element comes from, but I know there are charts basically where people have worked out what is the synthetic pathway that gets you to each of the different elements from the forces and temperatures and pressures that are available inside operating stars of different types and supernova of different types.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, sir.
Great, thank you. So that raises an interesting question. Can an element be broken down any further?
Yeah, it happens all the time in nuclear reactors and in naturally occurring radioactivity. You know, people make fun of the alchemists because they tried to turn lead into gold, and, you know, everyone knows that you can't do that. Well, actually, you can do that. It has been done. It's just that the alchemists didn't have access to nuclear reactors. They were trying to do it with chemistry, and you can't do it with chemistry, but you absolutely can do it with neutron beams and reactors of that sort and particle accelerators. It's just a different technology that they didn't have access to.
Mm-hmm. So I want to return a little bit to your acquiring elements. What was the hardest to acquire? I mean, you had to have completeness for this book eventually.
Thorium is pretty tricky. Of course, there's some that thorium is probably the most difficult which it's possible and legal to have a substantial quantity of. Mm-hmm. There's things like plutonium, which exists in large quantities, but just try to get your hands on some. You know, the FBI would be the least of my worries if I had any measurable amount of plutonium. And then there's ones which are very, very short half-lives, francium and actinium and things like that, where if you had some, you'd just be dead right then, because if you had mm-hmm. a visible quantity of it, it would be so fiercely radioactive that it would just sort of explode on it spontaneously. Mm-hmm. So these things basically don't exist in photographable quantities.
And what is it that makes it difficult to get about thorium? What is?
Well, there just aren't any particular reasons for anybody to make it available. It has no applications where somebody would make it available for sale. It's perfectly legal. It's like uranium. You're allowed to have, as a private individual with a legitimate reason, up to 15 pounds of it at any one time.
Hmm.
It's not, a weapons-grade material. It's not something you can do anything terribly bad with. It's not particularly rare. It's actually more common in the Earth's crust than uranium, which is a lot easier to get a hold of. But it's just, it just sort of falls through the cracks of availability.
This is Focus, and I'm Bill Hammack. I'm talking with Tao Gray, author of The Elements, a visual exploration of every known atom in the universe. It's a mesmerizing photographic display of all the elements in the periodic table. Tao is a co-founder of Wolfram Research, creator of the Mathematica Notebook Interface, and a columnist for Popular Science magazine. I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL. If you're in the area or anywhere else, call me at 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455, 800-222-9455, or use email, WILL-live@illinois.edu. We have another caller, Tao, that I want to turn to. So caller on line number one in Lovington?
Yeah.
On a combine, apparently. Is that right?
Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, go ahead.
Hey, I was wondering, where is chemistry and physics? I mean, do they meet someplace? What's the difference? It seems at some level they must get blurry. I was just wondering what the definition and difference of them is.
That's a fascinating question, and because that was a little bit of a weak signal, let me repeat it. The caller asked, where's the dividing line between physics and chemistry? At some level in the elements, do they meet?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of overlap in some cases between what physicists do and what chemists do. I think you could describe it basically that physicists typically operate on simpler systems than chemists do. In other words, a physicist might study a single atom or a beam of atoms, and they might study, the behavior of the electrons within an atom, whereas chemists start putting these things together into large molecules that become impossible to study using the typical tools that physicists use, which you can use to understand one or two atoms at a time. And they start looking at them on a wider scale, which leads to the criticism of physicists who describe chemists as stamp collectors because they're basically just looking at hundreds of different kinds of chemicals and trying to understand them all, as opposed to physicists who really understand one of them at a very deep level. But really, when you get down to it, physical chemists are doing a lot of the same things that physicists are doing, and what physicists learn about atoms is very useful to chemists in understanding how more complicated groupings of them work.
So in preparing this book, when it moved from hobby to one where you needed completeness, what was the hardest to photograph?
The hardest to photograph? Well, they all have their challenges. Powders are very difficult to make look interesting because they all kind of tend to look the same.
Mm-hmm.
So we make a lot of effort to try to find non-powdered forms of elements. The rare earths, which are a grouping of 14 elements, are difficult because they're all so similar and their applications are often quite similar. And they typically tend to occur not in pure form in their application. So it's hard to find interesting examples where the element exists as a lump of something that's not a compound. So, you know, some of them I've had to resort to compounds and to, you know, even powders, although I hate to do that.
Mm-hmm. And was there any that it was really hard to find uses for? I mean, these wonderful illustrations of them. Is everything used in some way?
Well, everything is used somehow. Now, I actually had a sentence in here describing thulium as the least useful element of all, which is a phrase that I got from John Emsley, who's another author of element books. And as soon as I said that, I ran into a guy, ended up having lunch with him, who was incensed that anybody would describe thulium as useless, because it turns out it's incredibly important to people in the lighting industry, because it, when it's subjected to an electrical discharge and heated to a very high temperature, it emits a particular spectrum of light that's very useful to them to fill in the color spectrum of some of these high-intensity discharge lights.
Hmm.
So it turns out, you know, pretty much any element, you can find a guy who'll stand up for it and say that it's a really important, useful element. But, you know, when you get right down to it, some of the rare earths are pretty iffy in terms of being useful.
And one thing I was curious about is some of the odd places you found elements. You mentioned something about a piercing shop. But what is a piercing shop, and what element did you find there?
Well, piercing shop, that's where we would teenagers go to get things stuck in them, you know, tongue rings and that kind of thing. And it turns out niobium, which is a lovely element, is particularly useful for that because it's a combination of properties. It's you know, immune from attack by the body, so it's kind of like titanium. You can use it for implants and things that are going to be in contact for a long time. It doesn't cause allergic reactions, but it can also be colored by an electric process where you form an oxide coating on it. And it makes, you know, it's possible to make very durable, very beautiful colored coatings on the niobium. So it's particularly nice for things like earrings or other kinds of piercing jewelry.
So if a listener wanted to, you know, start constructing their own table, is there a place where you can just go buy a pure element very cheaply?
Well, there's companies that will sell you sets of all the elements, nicely ampouled in pure form. I consider that kind of cheating. What's really more fun is to go and look around you and try to find examples of the elements, you know, either in your immediate surroundings or at Walmart, for example. There's at least 20 or 30 that you can find at Walmart in reasonably pure form.
At Walmart, you can find pure elements?
Oh, quite a few.
What's an example?
So some obvious ones would be aluminum. Mm-hmm. You get an aluminum cooking pan that's reasonably pure aluminum. Iron is not too hard to find. If you don't mind coatings, you can find chrome plating, which is typically very pure chrome, although a very thin layer of it, but nevertheless. Some of the more interesting ones, you can find magnesium in the camping section. They sell, and if not at Walmart, then at any of the sporting goods stores, they sell little blocks of reasonably pure solid magnesium, which are used as fire starters. And the idea is you take a hunting knife or something,
mm-hmm.
you carve off shavings off this block of magnesium, and then it has a little flint on it, and you strike the flint, and it will light the magnesium, which will then burn very hot and will light your campfire.
Hmm. So we've been talking about individual elements, but one of the great accomplishments of science was to find a fundamental organizing principle to group elements. And as most people know, that principle is represented by the periodic table. Can you describe how and why the elements are organized in this table in a particular way?
Well, the periodic table is sort of one of the great triumphs of scientific thought because it pulls together and organizes such a large amount of different there's a large amount of information that's encoded in it. The basic unit of organization is the atomic number, which is the number of protons in each atom of a given element. And that's kind of listed left to right, reading like lines of text in increasing order.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's also a bunch of different gaps and columns which are organized that way because they group together elements which have similar chemical properties, and they're similar chemical properties because they have the same number of electrons in the outermost, which is to say the most active shell of electrons. And the realization that it was possible to organize elements in this way was, you know, one of the most important things in turning chemistry into a really exact science.
So once you have that periodic table, you see regularities in the elements and can begin to predict some behaviors and how they go together. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, and in fact, one of the reasons why people started believing that there was such a thing as periodicity in the properties of the elements is that people like Dmitri Mendeleev, who is usually the one credited with inventing the table, organized the elements that were known at that time into a table and found that there were gaps. And he could say, right here, there ought to be an element, and it ought to have properties similar to these two or somewhere in between these two. And then sometimes as much as 20 years later, that element was discovered and had exactly the properties that he said it would. Mm-hmm. And after a few of those, people started to realize that he was really onto something. And, you know, it's one thing to take elements that you already have and sort of force them into some kind of a pattern. But it's quite another to say, you know, I've got this pattern and I predict that there's a new one here, even though no one's seen it yet, and then be right about that.
So that brings up the question, in this day and age, are there any more elements to be found?
Yes, there's actually no limit to the number of elements. It's simply the number of protons in the nucleus. You could say element 243, that's an element. The only question is, could you ever make it, and what would its half-life be? Mm-hmm. So far, as of today, elements all the way through 118 have been discovered, although elements 113 through 118 don't yet have official names because mm-hmm. there's still some arguing about who discovered them first and who gets to name them and what the name is going to be. Coincidentally, 118 is the last element that fits on a conventional format of the periodic table. Hmm. After that, you need to start a new row. And since no elements beyond 118 have been discovered yet, they haven't added that row. But there's nothing magical about 118. And in fact, there's theories that predict that 120 or 122 might actually be more stable and have a longer half-life than some of the lower numbered elements. Hmm. And they will no doubt be discovered. And then people like me who publish periodic tables will be forced to decide whether it's worth adding a whole new row or not.
So this is Bill Hammack, and I'm visiting with Tao Gray. We're discussing the chemical elements, everything you wanted to know about them but didn't know where to ask. I invite you to call with your questions at 800-333-WILL. If you're in the area anywhere else, call me at 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 at 800-222-9455. Or use email, WILL-live@illinois.edu. So I want to turn now to another way that you have distributed this book, so to speak. In addition to this traditional bound book, you've created an iPad version. Can you describe the app? I mean, what can you do with it?
The app is essentially, I think, what people these days are referring to as an enhanced e-book. Mm-hmm. So first and foremost, it is the entire book, all the text, all the pictures, all the contents that's in the print book is also in the iPad electronic book version. But there's also a lot more. So, for example, in the print book, each element is represented by one photograph. It's paper, so it doesn't really do anything other than just sit there and show you one picture of that element. In the iPad version, you can take your finger and spin any of those elements and see them turning around a complete circle and see it from all sides, which is possible because we photographed all these samples on a turntable where we took a picture every half degree all the way around. So we're able to create this much richer sort of interactive form of the book.
And had you done that when you were developing the book, that you knew perhaps?
We actually started photographing, and that's myself and Nick Mann, who's now my full-time element photographer, probably the only professional element photographer in the world. We've actually been photographing these things. I mean, I started in 2002, I guess, and very quickly started very crudely photographing them around a circle to make VR objects out of them. And we now do this routinely and have been for years photographing every sample to a very high standard on a turntable, not intentionally thinking about an iPad version because, you know, up until last April, there was no such thing as an iPad.
Fair enough.
But simply because I wanted to create a comprehensive record and I thought it might be useful at some point. And it's turned out to be, you know, very useful both for the iPad and also for video projects that we do, museum installations and you know, licensed to TV shows and things that need animating elements.
So we have another caller I want to get to right away. Caller on line one from Decatur, please go ahead.
I've been so pleased to see that intersection between science and art that Wolfram Research does. At Richland Community College, we're hosting an exhibit by Michael Trott and his photography of mathematical concepts and such. And I'm wondering if there are feasibilities of, you know, showing these also as art.
Tale?
Well, so we have, I don't know about art, you know, I hate to call this art, but we have installations in a number of places where this imagery is presented in more or less an artistic context. The one in particular is there's a Chemical Heritage Foundation museum in Philadelphia, which is a very beautiful museum space, very artistically done. You know, and it has a 5 foot wide by 19 foot high video wall that is running our elements, you know, images on it, essentially as art, although, of course, it's chemical themed art because it's the Chemical Heritage Foundation.
That is so, I do appreciate that because it brings another kind of expression to the everyday things that we need to be aware of. Well, thank you very much.
All right, and I want to turn to another caller then on line four. So caller on line four from Spring Bay. Oops, I'm sorry, we lost that caller. That may have been my fault, the caller from Spring Bay, if you call back. I appreciate that. So let's follow up on the iPad version a little bit. There's a remarkable story that you essentially created this iPad version in 60 days. Is that true, and how did that come about?
Well, so the paper book came out basically for Christmas last year. It was out in September of 2009. And after that was published, you know, I kind of thought about the idea that, you know, this is a really nice book, and it's a pity that you can't touch these things on the paper version and spin them, because I know I have the imagery to do that. Mm-hmm. And it would be kind of neat to make an electronic version of this book where you could spin them all, or where they could all be animating in some way. And the problem with this was that it would be a lot of work to do it, and there wasn't really any distribution mechanism where I could see selling this and making enough money for it to be worth doing, because it really would be a lot of work. You can't really sell this kind of material as software for PCs or whatever. People just don't pay for it, or they pirate it. You can't make enough money online on a website for this to be worthwhile. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I was kind of just had this in the back of my mind thing. You know, I wish somebody would invent a device. Kindle was out, but Kindle has a screen that makes it impossible to do color or interactivity of any sort. You know, it was just kind of sitting there in the back of my head. And then Apple came out and announced the iPad. And what they did actually is they announced, then they described it, and they showed pictures of it. And they said, in 60 days, we're going to be shipping this thing. And within a few minutes, I thought, wow, this is the exact device I've been waiting for. It has all the characteristics that I need. It has a beautiful screen. It has a powerful enough processor. But most importantly, it has the iTunes Store, which is a place in which it's possible to sell something for $10 or $15 and have people actually be willing to buy it and have Apple handle all of the complicated logistics of selling something at that price point. So together with my partner Max Whitby and Nick Mann and a developer in Ireland, John Crummie, we just kind of decided we were going to drop everything else that we were doing and bet on this being a worthwhile project. Mm-hmm. And we pulled it together. Actually, Apple had a 1 week delay, which was really nice. So we got an extra 7 days on top of the announced 60 days.
So we have a couple of questions I want to turn to. First of all, I want to return to that caller in Spring Bay. Caller, line four, are you there?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, please go ahead. What question do you have for Teo Gray?
I've been hearing of looming shortages of potash.
And I'm wondering, is potash an element, and can it be synthesized? Because I think it's pretty important for agriculture. Mm-hmm. I'll get off and listen. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, potash is a potassium compound. In fact, I have a picture. I have a bag of garden. It's actually called. The picture I have is sulfate of potash, but it's essentially the same stuff. And it's not an element, but it's a compound where one of the elements, namely the potassium, is sort of the most important one and the hardest one to come by. I don't know. I mean, there. You always read about shortages of one thing or another. In fact, there was a series in the magazine that I write for that used a bunch of pictures of mine to represent elements that are looming in short supply. And it's always a little hard to say whether that's just because the current known supplies are running low, but once people start looking for more, they'll find lots. It could also be real. I don't know. I'm not really an expert in which elements are rare. I mean, of course, basically, you know, there's a heck of a lot of people in the world, and I don't think there's many resources that are not ultimately going to be in short supply one way or the other.
Teo, we have two email questions from a listener called Ron in Urbana, and they're both fascinating questions. The first is, are there any insights to be gained by organizing the elements into a three-dimensional table?
Possibly. So there's a guy, Roy Alexander, that I've worked with who is the inventor of what's known as the Alexander arrangement, which is a three-dimensional sort of looping form of the periodic table. Basically, the periodic table is a multi-cyclic sort of a thing, and when you flatten it down into two dimensions, you've kind of obscured some of the relationships that are there. For example, the left side is really connected to the right side. So what Alexander has done is turn it into a loop where you see that. And there's other people that have tried to arrange it in other three-dimensional ways. I think one of the problems is that it's actually more than three-dimensional, and you know you can preserve more of its logical structure in three dimensions than in two. On the other hand, you end up with an unwieldy three-dimensional object rather than something you can print in a book. Hmm. So it's all a lot of compromises. And in fact, there's people who argue about how the periodic table should be arranged. There's more than just one arrangement. The one that you've seen is just sort of the most common. There's other ways of arranging it that bring out different aspects of the relationship between the elements. A spiral one, for example, has been popular. Mm-hmm.
So the Ron in Urbana has a second question. Is there any alternative to China as a useful source of the rare earth elements?
Again, I'm not an expert in where these things are found. China is a place that has an awful lot of rare earths. But as I understand it, actually, the U.S. has a pretty good supply as well. Another one that people ask about is lithium, where there's certain countries in South America that have what are often referred to as the world's only large supplies of lithium, which might be very important if lithium batteries in cars, for example, start using up huge amounts of that. But on the other hand, it turns out, well, there's brines under California that may have, vast amounts of lithium. If the price were just a little bit higher, then it would be worth extracting from them. And maybe the whole South American connection would just sort of become unimportant because with a slight adjustment in the price, other sources would become more important. So these things are subtle, and I think the panics are often overblown because it turns out to be easier than one might think to either find new sources or else switch to some completely different element to solve the same problem.
This is Focus, and I'm Bill Hammack. I'm talking with Teo Gray, designer of the amazing iPad app called The Elements, based on his popular book. And we're also discussing the iPad itself. What impact will it have on books, newspapers, and other printed media? And I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL if you're in the area. Anywhere else, 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Or use email, WILL-live@illinois.edu. So let's look at the iPad, first of all, from an author's perspective. In a traditional book, I think that the author gets perhaps 10% royalties. Is that a fair number, or a reasonable number?
Depending on the book, 10 to 20% would be fairly typical.
And 20 would be the very high end, would it not?
It depends on the type of book. For something like a novel, mm-hmm. where it's just black and white text on mm-hmm. cheap paper, The production costs are relatively lower, and the author would get a higher royalty. Mm-hmm. For a coffee table photo book, where the production costs are significantly higher, but the retail price can't be much higher, then the author's royalty would be typically towards the lower end of that, mm-hmm. just because there's less profit available.
Sure. And so tell me, when one writes an iPad app, which is a kind of e-book, and we'll probe that a little bit, what is the split that the author gets? And
well, that, of course, is somewhat in flux because there's less well-established relationships and types of companies involved in this. One thing is that it's much more practical for an author in some cases to create their own iPad app than it is for an author to print and distribute their own book. And this is particularly true for things involving color printing. A book like my Elements book, it would really be very challenging for me as an individual to arrange for printing and distribution at a price that the market would bear, because really the only way to print this book cost effectively and be able to sell it for $20 or so retail is by printing it in China in large quantities and shipping it in containers. And that's just not an easy thing for mm-hmm. One person to do for one book. Whereas in the case of the iPad, it's kind of back to the old garage software development process, where if you have the technical knowledge to produce a thing like that, it doesn't cost a whole lot other than your own time, and you can then just throw it up on the App Store and Apple starts sending you free money, and there's no there's no cost involved. You don't have to print stuff, you don't have to ship it, you don't have to get agreements with Barnes and Noble and Borders and such to get it into their bookstores. Mm-hmm. You just put it up there, and if you've got a quality product and you do some marketing, you get to keep. Apple keeps 30% of the list price. You get 70%, mm-hmm. and that just it's just money. It doesn't. It's not like the print publishing business where you have to deal with all of these hassles of actually creating physical objects and moving them around.
Mm-hmm. And so, can you share with us how has this done as maybe a percent of the iPads that it's on, or can you characterize how the Elements book is done?
Well, so there's a percent. I don't know. The last figure I heard was 3 million iPads, but that was several months ago. I'm sure it's many more than that. Mm-hmm. And as of yesterday, we've sold about 130,000 copies of the app. I know at one time it was as high as 2 or 3% of iPads that had copies. I think it's a lower percentage now because they sold so many more iPads, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there's so much more competition out there now.
So let's put that 130,000 in perspective. For just a typical book, that would be a large number of sales for a book.
That's not bad. I mean, the print book has sold about twice as many copies if you count the foreign editions. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, in terms of money to the author, we get to keep all of the money from the iPad version because we are the publisher, mm-hmm. And we only get a relatively modest royalty from the print book. And that reflects the fact that in the case of the iPad app, beyond the initial cost of producing it, there's virtually no costs in selling more copies. They just are electrons. They kind of make more of them on the fly. Whereas in the case of the paper book, the publisher really doesn't have nearly as much profit available per copy because they actually have to print them and warehouse them and ship them.
So let's take a little deeper look at the iPad and at ebooks. And I'm interested in your responses to it, both as an interface designer and eventually here as a publisher. So put on your designer hat and describe to me, what do you think the iPad really got right and whether it will change how we use computers?
I guess thinking about it as an ebook platform, that's to say as a reading platform, of course, it has many other uses. It's a wonderful games platform. It's great for email. It has many things that it does other than book reading. But since I'm, concerned with books, I'll just talk about it as a reading platform. Mm-hmm. And the main issue there is comparing it to Kindle and to that style of e-paper readers. And I think the thing that it really gets right is that it's a real computer with a real screen that allows you to do more than just display text on the page. The Kindle is great if what you have is, a long-form narrative text that you want to display, and pretty much all you'd ever want to do to it is change the font size and maybe be able to do text search and maybe leave notes or something. But basically, you have static text that you'd like to read. The Kindle does fine for that. But as soon as you want to do something else, like have color photographs or animations or video or interactive diagrams, let's say it's a textbook, you want to have diagrams that you can touch and interact with, or, you know, change the scenarios, whatever, anything like that, the Kindle just flat out can't do it. It's disqualified by the hardware technology of its screen. Whereas the iPad is much more like an actual computer. I mean, it is. It's a 1 gigahertz processor. It's got decent horsepower behind it, mm-hmm. and it has a screen where you can do, you know, anything that you can think of in your mind that you can write the code to do, you can pretty much do it with an iPad.
So if, maybe we would characterize it this way, that the Kindle is reversioning another medium, but an iPad book is really recreating what an e-book is.
Yeah, the Kindle is recreating paper books. The iPad is allowing mm-hmm. people to invent new types of books. Or I don't know if you want to call them books. You know, mm-hmm. I don't think they have a really good name. But, you know, these new things, which they're not movies, they're not TV shows, they're not books in the conventional sense. Mm-hmm. They're something new and interesting.
So you're so excited about the iPad. So I want to follow up on what you said there, that you've started a company called Touch Press. And that is really to publish iPad books, maybe other platforms. We'll discuss that. What does it take to make a good iPad or electronic book in this newer sense that you're talking about? Do you simply need text, or do you need more?
Well, you need everything that goes into a conventional book, and then you need something more. So, you know, the kind of books that we want to publish and that we are publishing are books that have, you know, really interesting new kinds of media in them. Some of them have straight video, but that's really, you know, minimal. Mostly it's sort of touch interactive visualizations and objects that you can interact with using the touch device. But they also, and this is very important, they also have real stories and text written by actual authors who know how to write. I think this is sort of a failing of some of the other attempts at enhanced or interactive e-books, is that they spend too much time on the gimmicks and not enough time on actually being good books. Mm-hmm. I think that's a criteria that we want to stick to, is that any of these books, these e-books that we publish, could stand as paper books as well and be successful. And in fact, many of them we will end up working with paper publishers to have print editions of them published. And we're working with real authors who can create a compelling storyline and tell the stories that we want to tell in these books. And without that, it's not a book. You know, then it's just mm-hmm. sort of, I don't know what it is, but it's not a book if it doesn't have good stories in it.
A multimedia adventure or something. But your core is that it needs to work as a book and be enhanced by the iPad. So mm-hmm. I don't know what the status of Touch Press is. Is there any of the books coming out that you could share with us what it is, to give an example of how this enhances it?
I think we are currently not actually saying what our projects are. We have three that will be out by Christmas, fingers crossed, and if I don't spend too much time on the radio. But we've not announced what any of those are yet, and we have a bunch more in the pipeline. One of the things that's been very gratifying is that the success of the Elements has caused publishers to come to us with some of their most interesting projects, wanting to know, could this be turned into an e-book, and how would we do that?
Mm-hmm. So here's a question that appears simple, but you tell me if it is. What's the correct price of an e-book?
Yes. Well, you'll get a lot of our opinions about that. And not to mention the correct price of an app. For those who don't follow these discussions, it might seem very arcane, but it's actually an incredibly important precedent that's being set for the future about what these things ought to cost. And, you know, the price is somewhere between $0 and $20 or so. So we price the Elements at $13.99, and the origin of that price is that at the time when the iPad was just coming out, and really there was no precedent that had been set yet, several publishers publicly announced that they were going to price their ebooks at $12.99. And, other people argued $9.99. Amazon was very firm on $9.99. And mm-hmm. there was a big battle between $9.99 and $12.99. But $12.99 seemed to be a line that a number of large publishers were drawing in the sand and saying, we're not going to go below that. And my opinion is that the Elements book is better than any of their books, so it ought to cost a dollar more. And so we priced it at $13.99. It's a question we will never know the answer to. If we had charged, let's say, $9.99 or $7.99 instead, would we have made more money? by selling that many more copies? Or if we charge $19.99, would we have made more money? These are very interesting questions that I would very much like to know the answer to, but it's impossible ever to test it because, you know, anytime you change the price or try to have a different book or whatever, the circumstances are always different.
Well, is one of the things that apparently newspapers and magazines would like is a second platform comparable to the iPad to introduce some competition there. Is there anything on the horizon like that that you know of?
There's several things on the horizon. There's of course, Android is the one that everyone talks about. There's Android tablets that are coming out. Nintendo has announced the device. You know, it'll be very interesting. I think people will see a lot of, you know, competition and back and forth and experimentation in hardware and price points for the readers. One factor that I think people underestimate the importance of is the store. That, you know, it's all well and good to have an Android tablet that maybe matches or even exceeds the technical specifications of the iPad. But if you don't have a distribution mechanism that encourages people to actually pay money for the products that you're trying to sell them, then you won't get very many products being developed of certain types. I mean, you'll get the types of products that can work as free or very low-cost apps, but you won't get the type of products that require a higher price point in order to be successful if there isn't a store where that's possible. And Apple, to its credit, has created this kind of almost magical iTunes store where, you know, where people will actually pay $9.99 for a book or 99 cents for a song that ordinarily they would always just download. And whether – I think the big open question for other platforms is not so much the hardware, but rather the store.
Well, it's not the secret to the iPod a bit that it was not the first MP3 player, but it had a great design and it gathered it together in this store and that combination.
Yeah, yeah. I think the money-spinning ability came about largely because of the store. The hardware was nice. It was better than anybody else's hardware, but it was really the store that put it together.
So we have about 4 or 5 minutes left here, and one thing I want to return to as kind of a curiosity is your iPad app plays the Tom Lehrer song. And first of all, that's the song that we used to introduce this, and you kindly brought along a Japanese version. And so let's listen to a little bit of that Japanese version of the Tom Lehrer song. Great. So, so tell us a little bit about this Tom Lehrer song.
I mean, the Tom Lehrer song. So, the original was recorded in 1959, and it's really a classic. You know, I've heard actually at the Ig Nobel ceremony that I was at one time, I heard the studio audience or the audience at this theater singing along to that song. These were Harvard students. So that, you know, that's how well known that original is among certain very nerdy circles. And we included in the app just, you know, for fun. I actually made a deal with Tom Lehrer, who's now 81 years old. I traded him an iPad for the rights to use his song in my app, and we were both very pleased with that deal. But now the Elements app has sold so many copies in Japanese. We have a Japanese edition of the app, fully translated. And as with many things to do with science and attractive things like that, the Japanese loved it and have bought so many copies that I felt they deserved a Japanese version of the Elements song because the Japanese app currently includes only the English version. Coincidentally, I have a cousin who's a professional musician who's lived in Osaka for 20 years. So I was all set up to have the necessary contacts to arrange a Japanese version. And the singer is actually my 13-year-old twin cousins once removed. who turn out to be excellent singers who are willing to learn this song and perform it. So that's going to be part of the Japanese version of the Elements app early next month.
And so that app is not out in Japan yet, is it?
It's out in Japan. Okay. It's been out for quite a while, and it sold very well there. But with the English song in it, all the text is translated. Mm-hmm. But the song was harder to translate than just the text.
Mm-hmm. So in the minute or so that we have left, let's return maybe to the elements a little bit. And I've asked you your favorites and other questions. But is there an ugly duckling among the elements that doesn't get enough respect? Maybe not your favorite, but you know,
doesn't get enough respect. Well, the rare earths are widely looked down upon. I don't know. I mean, people, you know, people dislike some of the toxic elements, lead and mercury and things like that. They're, you know, or cadmium. You pretty much only ever hear bad things about cadmium or any of those toxic elements, which is kind of a pity because some of them are really quite attractive. In a toxic sort of a way. Plutonium obviously has a very bad reputation because really its only widely known application is blowing people up. But again, you know, it's just an element. I don't think one should ascribe too many evil thoughts to it.
So we do have one more caller. I don't quite think we have time to fit him in. I'm looking, it's 11:57 here. So, Teo, thanks for taking the time to chat today.
Well, thank you. I was delighted to be here.
I'm Bill Hammack, and I've been talking to Teo Gray, author of The Elements, a visual exploration of every known atom in the universe. It's a mesmerizing photographic display of all the elements in the periodic table. And also, we've been discussing his iPad adaptation of the book. The technical director for this segment was Jason Croft, and the producer was Harriet Williamson. We'll have more of Focus coming up in a few minutes. But first, we'll break for a market update and news from National Public Radio.